This is the first day of this January 2017 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin. Rohatsu means the eighth day of the 12th month, 12th lunar month. Rohatsu Sesshin is generally conducted in December by our Gregorian calendar, but with all of the hullabaloo about the holidays in December many years ago, I switched it to January to get free of all that gravitational pull toward worldly concerns. This is also just a note about the new Buddha figure. We have a 7.5 foot tall Buddha figure, 7.5 feet if you count the base, that we were given in December from an estate sale, and apparently they weren't able to sell it, and so they wanted it to go to a working temple, and we became the beneficiaries of that. It's too tall and too dark for any place at Arnold Park, but I think we have found just the place for it in the basement level of the south building here, the foot of the main stairs coming down from the large bell, hanging bell. It's darkly shellacked, so we may try to find a way to light the face better, especially because it's the face that is the face is the best part of this Buddha figure. It really has a deeply contemplative expression, or no expression, samadhi, really, as I see it. It's not so common in Buddha figures to have such a deep repose. And so we have it there at the bottom of the main stairs. And I hope people can feel some inspiration from it. We're going to go back to one of my favorite masters, Japanese masters, Bankei. Whose years are 1622 to 1693. There are two good translations of the same material, his biography and his teachings. I'm going to start with the biography as translated by Norman Waddell, and the book is called The Unborn: The Life and Teaching of Zen Master Bankei. And he did the translation and offers this introduction. So the introduction is the biographical material. So he was born in 1622. To give people who have some sense of Western history what that translates as in the West, it was the era of Descartes, Galileo, Hobbes, Newton, Swedenborg in Sweden. It was the beginning of Unter den Linden, Germany. Beginning of the extermination of American Indians. Sweden was riding high. It was a real powerhouse among nations, and a more daily life kind of thing. It's beginning of coffee houses in Europe and ice cream in France. I'm going to sometimes read verbatim here, sometimes paraphrase or skip passages. The Bankei's family, for generations, had been physicians of samurai rank. Bankei was one of nine children, the fourth of five sons. His boyhood name was Muchi, which translates roughly as "don't fall behind." And he didn't. When he was 10, his father died, and his eldest brother was left with the duty of raising him and the other children. That is, it was the eldest brother and Bankei's mother. The eldest son continued the family tradition as a practitioner of Chinese medicine. The records of Bankei's life show that he was intelligent and highly sensitive, but at the same time rather unruly and uncommonly strong-willed. We'll hear more about that, plenty more as we go on. His mother later told him that even from the young age of 2 or 3, he showed an aversion to death. This is something you see in other of those who became great masters, not uncommonly. I think of Zen Master Dogen. There were others. The family found that by talking about death or pretending to be dead, they could stop his crying. Later, when he made a nuisance of himself by leading the neighborhood children in mischief, the same methods were used to bring him into line. He showed an aversion to death. We all are part of the same sea of basic suffering. What in the Buddha's life are called the four sights, or at least the first three: sickness, old age, and death. But these basic facts of painful existence do affect some more than others. Bankei seems to have really felt it. There's a proverb, a Japanese or Chinese proverb, maybe both, says discipline begins with the fear of death. And we're told of that, and there's an annual boys' festival in Bankei's village, where there'd be these stone-throwing contests. They divide into sides and throw small stones at one another from opposite sides of a nearby river. This annual event had been held in the district there for over 500 years, in order to inculcate the warrior virtues in the young boys. And it seems that whichever side Bankei was on invariably won, because he would never retreat, no matter how hard the stones rained down on him. When he was 11, less than a year after his father's death, he was sent to the village school, where he took an immediate interest in his studies. But the calligraphy lessons held after school at a temple in a neighboring village were a different matter. For these, he had an intense dislike. And to avoid the tedious monotony of copying and recopying Chinese characters from the teacher's copybook, he made a practice of always returning home well before the class was over. His older brother took him to task repeatedly for this, but his scolding had little effect. In returning home, Banca had to cross a river. His brother instructed the ferryman not to allow him to board if he should come along early, that is, if he had cut classes. Banca was not easily to be denied. He declared, "The ground must continue under the water," and he strode right into the stream, struggling along the bottom until he emerged breathless at the far bank. And then there came a time when Banke, to avoid further conflict with his older brother, thought of committing suicide. This is suicide. It's hard for us as Westerners to appreciate the honor with which suicide is regarded in Japan, more so anyway than here. Banke had heard that eating poisonous spiders was fatal, so he swallowed a mouthful of them and shut himself up inside a small Buddhist shrine to await the end. Many hours later, seeing that he was still alive, he abandoned the attempt and went home. And back to this recitation of Confucian texts, repeated over and over until they came automatically to the lips. This was the rote learning that was just standard in Japan and China, maybe still is to a large extent, although things are changing somewhat. One day the class was taking up one of the four great books of Confucianism. It was called The Great Learning. And the teacher came to the central words, "The way of great learning lies in clarifying bright virtue." Banke interrupted the teacher. "What is bright virtue?" he asked. And the teacher repeated the standard line, which was, bright virtue is the intrinsic nature of good in each person. Banke pushed back. "What is the intrinsic nature of man?" And he was told, "It's his fundamental nature." Banke persisted, "Then what is that?" The teacher replied, "The ultimate truth of heaven." But that, too, did not satisfy Banke. This was a great turning point in Banke's life, this mention of bright virtue, because it really stuck in his craw. It somehow grabbed his questioning in a way that held him for years. Virtue here does not mean the opposite of evil. Virtue here is much broader meaning. Really, it's more closer to the suchness of things, the completeness of things. Yes, the nature of things. And this is what he needed to understand in terms of his own experience. The translator here says, "This questioning marks the awakening of religious doubt," meaning questioning. Doubt here means questioning, "in his consciousness, which was most likely already disposed in that direction because of the recent loss of his father." Banke later spoke of this critical juncture, 60 years later, as the beginning of his search to discover the Buddha mind. And this questioning grew into an all-consuming passion. He embarked on an urgent and relentless quest that would occupy the next 14 years and determine the future course of his life. He started by asking everyone he felt might be able to give him the answer. A group of Confucian scholars came up with nothing to offer, and they advised him that he might try a Zen monk because they know about such knotty problems. There were no Zen temples in the immediate vicinity, so he couldn't follow their advice at that time, at that young age. So he had to content himself with questioning more Confucianists and other Buddhist priests, non-Zen Buddhist priests in the nearby temples. He also attended every talk, lecture, meeting, discussion group, and other religious gathering that he heard about. Afterward, he would run home and tell his mother what had been said. There's a footnote here. It said, Bankei's mother spent the latter half of her life as a Buddhist nun living in a small temple. And Bankei, it said, always found time to visit her. She lived to the age of 90. Dying in her son's arms in 1680. The extent of Bankei's devotion to his mother and his deep commitment to the principles of filial piety can be felt throughout the discourses, his own talks, we'll get to later. In an entry in one of those, an entry in another text, it said, Bankei once spoke in a discourse of the sense of filial piety that he felt as a boy, which was responsible, he said, for his entry into religious life in the first place and for his subsequent achievement of enlightenment. Real filial devotion, he said, should not stop at merely caring for one's parents. A truly filial child should clarify the way of deliverance so as to be able to make his parents realize it too. Now back to the text. He would run home and tell his mother what he'd heard from these various sources about bright virtue. But, of course, since he was still asking others, this, it really was getting no traction, having a deeper understanding of this bright virtue. He couldn't find a single person who could offer him any guidance. And he became discouraged. His biography said he wandered about like a stray mountain lamb, aimlessly and alone. And his schoolwork lost all interest for him. And this aggravated his brother, his older brother, so much that the brother banished him from the family house for good. Bankei was 11, banished from the family house. It's hard to imagine that. So he's now thrown solely on his own resources. A close friend of the family took pity on him and stepped forward and offered him the use of a small hut in the hills behind his house. Bankei, according to the biography, Bankei does not seem to have been unduly troubled by this turn of events. On the contrary, he seems to have welcomed it as a chance to devote himself to his questioning, secure from all outside distraction. So he accepted the neighbor's offer, and he found a plank of wood, and on it he wrote the words, "Practice hermitage." So he, remember, 11 years old, and he propped it up outside the entrance to the hut, and settled down to devote himself to his own clarification of bright virtue. Then it says the records fell more or less silent regarding the next several years. He apparently tried some other Buddhist practices. At a temple of the Pure Land, local Pure Land school, the practice of the Nembutsu, the calling of the name of Amida Buddha, said that in his he later referred to long sessions he devoted to this constant repetition of this Nembutsu, and which he described as days on end in a Nembutsu samadhi. And now we jump up to when he was 15. He lived for a while in a Shingon Buddhist temple, another non-Zen Buddhist temple, and became familiarized with the teachings and practices of that sect. And then the head priest of that temple was so impressed with him, he tried to get him to stay on as his disciple. Bhante refused. Neither of these other Buddhist sects were to his liking. The next year, having turned 16, he walked the 20 miles that took him to the a temple of the Zen sect that had been built 22 years before the abbot there, Umpo Zenjo. Umpo belonged to the Rinzai tradition, the mainstream of that school. He was 70 years old when Bhante visited him, and this Umpo had earned a wide reputation as a stern taskmaster who demanded total dedication from his monks. A reference to Umpo later said that few were bold-hearted enough to enter his chambers, and they usually fled before long. So right off the bat, Bhante told Umpo of his problem of coming to terms with bright virtue. Umpo told him if he wanted to discover what it meant, he would have to practice Zazen, sitting. The translator here says there must have been something about Umpo and the Zen teachings and practice he embodied that struck a responsive chord in Bhante. Because then and there he asked Umpo to give him ordination as a Buddhist monk. Umpo, no doubt pleased to grant this request, coming as it did from such an obviously determined young man, immediately shaved Bhante's head. Bhante then spent 3 years under Umpo's guidance. Sitting was the main ingredient of the training. It says Bhante probably did some work on koans as well, although no clear evidence reveals this. And there is some indication that Umpo may not have laid the same stress on koans that his contemporaries did. When he was 19, Bhante set out again on an extended journey around the country. He stayed in temples, but more often he lived a solitary life in rude, self-made huts, or frequently, to judge from his records, he merely slept in the open. The privations of this life were great, but he faced them with a more than Spartan disdain for hunger and extremes of season and temperature. He is reported to have lived among beggars for several years. From the following account by Bankei himself, we can form a picture of what his life was like at this time. And these are Bankei's words. I pressed myself without mercy, draining myself mentally and physically. At times I practiced deep in the mountains, in places completely cut off from all human contact. I fashioned primitive shelters out of paper, pulled that over me, and did zazen seated inside. Sometimes I would make a small lean-to by putting up two walls of thick paper boards and sit in solitary darkness inside, doing zazen, never lying down to rest even for a moment. Whenever I heard of some teacher whom I thought might be able to give me advice, I went immediately to visit him. I lived that way for several years. There were few places in the country I did not set foot. Well, 4 years of that, and he went back to Umpo. He was 23 now, and he was still no closer, supposedly, as the record says, no closer to resolving the doubt and incertitude pressing in upon him. They say that he was weeping in discouragement as he told Umpo how he had been unable to find a single person in all his travels who could give him the kind of help he wanted. Sounds like he was still hoping that someone would answer his question for him. What good would that do? What good would a verbal answer have possibly done for such a person consumed by questioning? The only thing that could possibly satisfy him, quench his thirst, or anyone's, is the direct experience of it, not being told by anyone. Umpo then said as much. He said, it's your desire to find someone that keeps you from your goal. So Bankei left again. This time he built a hermitage in the countryside. He now isolated himself completely from contact with the outside, walling himself up within his tiny dwelling. He sat constantly, day and night, dedicating himself with even greater urgency to zazen. He resolved, in the same way that the Buddha had resolved under the Bodhi tree, not to get up until he found his way through. It was the same with Shakyamuni, sitting, crossing his legs under the Bodhi tree and saying, never will I stir from this seat until I attain full enlightenment. Eventually, Bankei's buttocks and thighs became inflamed and swollen from constant contact with the bare rock floor. They began to fester, but he kept sitting. He gave up eating for weeks at a time. He threw cold water over himself whenever he felt even the slightest approach of the demons of sleep. And here's another description of his life at that time in his hut. The room, about 10 feet square, resembled nothing so much as a prison cell. There was only one small opening, just large enough for an arm to pass through. This, by the way, sounds like descriptions of such things in Tibet that I read about. The door he plastered shut with mud so that no one could enter to bother him. Food was passed to him through the hole in the wall twice each day. After he had finished eating it, he placed the bowl outside the opening once again. A privy was arranged just below the wall so that he could relieve himself from inside the room through a small aperture made for that purpose. But now his years of struggle had weakened him both physically and mentally. He contracted tuberculosis, and he described it this way: "My utter neglect of health and the years of physical punishment finally took its toll and came to a head in a serious illness. My condition steadily worsened. I grew weaker and weaker by the day. Whenever I spat, gouts of bloody sputum as big as thumb heads appeared. Once I spat against a wall and the globules stuck and slid to the ground in bright red beads. The illness reached a critical stage. For a whole week I was unable to swallow anything except some thin rice broth." Let me just interject that it's almost impossible for us to understand the extremes that he went to. But if you've ever felt the desperation to know your true nature, it could at least be less difficult to understand. It's get more of an inkling of the drive that comes from within. There was probably nothing at all in Bankei where he thought he should be punishing himself like that, sitting that much. No, that wasn't the point at all. He was out of his mind with needing to know. And so that's how he acted, in desperation. The physician who examined him at that point is reported to have thrown aside his medicine spoon. In other words, Bankei was past the point where such remedies could be of help. He was now resigned to dying. But then, when things were at their darkest, his struggle to attain enlightenment came to an end. And here are his words: "I felt a strange sensation in my throat. I spat against a wall. A mass of black phlegm, large as a soapberry, rolled down the side. Suddenly, just at that instant, I realized what it was that had escaped me until now. All things are perfectly resolved in the unborn." After 14 years of incredible hardship, he had achieved a decisive enlightenment, his doubts and uncertainties disappearing like a dream. Immediately he felt his strength begin to return. His appetite improved almost miraculously, and with it his health. These kind of stories, not that there are so many, but there are others like this that I've read in Taisho, these stories remind us that beyond this ordinary body-mind complex that we think as the whole substance of the matter, beyond it is this far greater matter of mind, true mind, the mind that transcends our ordinary discriminating mind. And that there is this intimate connection between the degree to which we're in harmony with this mind, our true mind, and our health. Not that that's the whole picture. There are other things, of course, genetic inheritances, our constitutional strength, and other things. But this so dramatically points to how this in Bankei's case, this complete oneness with his practice turned everything around for him in terms of his health. But he wasn't done. Soon after this, another enlightenment occurred. And this happened when the fragrant smell of plum blossoms was borne to him on the morning breeze as he was washing his face in a nearby stream. This is the account of this. The master, frustrated in all his attempts to resolve the feeling of doubt which weighed so heavily on his mind, became deeply disheartened. Signs of serious illness appeared. Okay, this is a repeat of what he already went through. He said to himself, "Everyone has to die. I'm not concerned about that. My regret is dying with the great matter I've been struggling with all these years, since I was a small boy, still unresolved." His eyes flushed with hot tears. His chest heaved violently. It seemed his ribs would burst. Then, just at that moment, enlightenment came to him, like the bottom falling out of a bucket. Immediately, his health began to return, but still he seemed unable to express what he had realized. Then, one day in the early hours of the morning, the scent of plum blossoms carried to him in the morning air reached his nostrils. At that instant, all attachments and obstacles were swept from his mind once and for all. The doubts that had been plaguing him ceased to exist. When he was strong enough to travel, he went back to Umpo and told him what had happened. Umpo was overjoyed. "This is the marrow of Bodhidharma's bones. From now on, no one anywhere will be able to touch you," he said. But he also told him that he should get verification from other masters. And he recommended a Gudo Toshoku, the most highly regarded Rinzai Zen teacher of the day. But then Bankei decided to try his luck with some of the other Zen teachers in the vicinity. Felt that none of them was up to his understanding. One of the priests confessed to him that what he taught people was not based on his own enlightenment. He really was not enlightened, he said. He merely repeated what he had learned from his teacher or what he had been able to grasp from his reading of Zen writings. Well, Bankei then spent the next year or so in small hermitages built at different sites along the forested hills in that area. And he applied himself to the important post-enlightenment phase of his training. And then word reached him of a Chinese priest, monk, by the name of Dosha, who had just arrived from China there. He arrived in Japan from China. He decided to go to see what this Dosha had to offer. During their first meeting, Dosha confirmed Bankei's enlightenment with the words, "You have penetrated through to the matter of the self." But then he added, "But you still have to clarify the matter beyond, which is the essence of our school." To Bankei, who was brimming with self-confidence, this was inconceivable. So firm was his belief that he had attained great enlightenment itself, full and perfect. So at first he refused to accept Dosha's evaluation and told him as much. According to one account, Bankei looked at Dosha, laughed loudly, and then stalked brusquely out of the room without even making his bows. But he didn't leave the temple. He stayed on for a few days, closely watching Dosha and the manner in which he instructed the monks under him. And then he came to see Dosha's real true qualities, and he made up his mind to continue his practice with him. In the months that followed, he went often to Dosha's quarters. Dosha didn't know Japanese. Remember, Dosha is from China. He didn't know Japanese, and Bankei could not speak Chinese, although he could read and write it. So they had to communicate by means of Hitsudan, which is the exchange of written notes in Chinese. Quote, with brushes in place of mouths and eyes in place of ears. Bankei took his place in the assembly of monks, lived with the rest of them, but he was unwilling to follow some of the customs of the temple. He was particularly averse to the practice of chanting sutras in Chinese. This little sidebar here, this was a real point of contention between our own founder, Roshi Philip Kaplow, and his teacher, Yasutani Roshi. Roshi Kaplow felt very strongly that the sutras, we should be able to chant the sutras in our own language, English, instead of keeping just to the Japanese. Of course, the Japanese had found their own Japanese versions of the Prajnaparamita and other sutras. The following year, on the 21st day of the third month, while sitting in the darkness of the meditation hall with the other monks, Bankei had another enlightenment experience. He left the hall, rushed to Dosha's chambers, took up a brush and wrote the question, "What is the ultimate matter of Zen?" Dosha's reply, again in writing, was, "Whose matter?" Bankei extended his arms out. Dosha took up his brush, but before he could write anything, Bankei grabbed it out of his hand and threw it to the floor. He then swung his sleeves and left. The next morning, Dosha told the monk in charge of the monk's hall that Bankei has completed the great matter. He then had the monk move Bankei to the position of senior monk, but then Bankei declined this. He preferred his old place near the kitchen, and he continued doing his chores just as before, stoking the kitchen fires with fuel and serving the other monks their meals. It seems that some of the other monks had resented Bankei's presence almost from the start. There's not many details from the biographical material, but the translator says, we may imagine that this his independent attitude, which the others took as an expression of disrespect toward their teacher, had something to do with their displeasure. In any case, when they learned that the master had acknowledged Bankei's enlightenment, the undercurrent of resentment erupted into strong feelings of jealousy. As soon as Dosha got wind of this, he called Bankei to him in secret and asked him to leave the temple for a while until matters quieted down to avoid an incident with the others. And that's all the time we have today. We'll pick up on this tomorrow and now recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings. without number, I bow to the prey. Endless blind passions, I bow to our root. Dharma gaze beyond measure, I bow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I bow to attain. All beings without number, I bow to liberate. Endless blind passions, I bow to uproot. Dharma gaze beyond measure, I bow to penetrate. The great way of Buddha, I bow to attain.